fleeting glimpses of things seen through a veil, darkly. Do we understand the meaning of these visions of life? Why we are here and how little of our existence we truly understand? Tonight we will talk of these things on The Other Side. Welcome to The Other Side. I'm Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again, and I think we're going to have a great discussion today. Our guest is Carl Abramson. We are going to talk about his new book, A Culture, The Unseen Forces That Drive Culture Forward. And Carl is a writer, publisher, magico-anthropologist, filmmaker, and photographer. Since the mid-1980s, he has been active in the magical community, integrating a culture as a way of life and lecturing about his findings and speculations. The editor and publisher of the annual anthology of A Culture, The Fenris Wolf, and the author of Resonances. He divides his time between Stockholm, Sweden, where I believe he may be today, and New York City. Carl, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Jim. It'll be fun.
And you sound fantastic. That's always great. So I have to ask you, I guess, start at the beginning here. How do you define what is a culture?
I think one of the ways to do it is simply by looking at the word, and you know, when doing that, you can then let it bloom into an almost infinite kind of flower. But just putting the words together, occult and culture, you know, it's kind of a punny way to do it, but it signifies a lot of things because, of course, we all know what culture is, and we usually think of the arts and, you know, old art and new art and literature and movies and stuff like that, everything that concerns us in our lives. But occult is something that, by definition or by the word, is hidden. It means hidden in Latin. So what are these things that have been hidden? Well, it could be many, many things, you know, for different reasons. But usually we talk about sort of hocus-pocus related stuff, things having to do with magic or rituals, primitive natural sciences, sort of experimental natural sciences, also primitive experimental psychology that have sort of developed throughout the century. You could say that that's an area where it's like research in praxis, so-called magicians and, you know, these proto-scientists in a way have experimented with the human mind, with human behavior and forces in nature. And they have been very often been ostracized, which is unfortunate, but that has changed now though. So that's basically the occult. So what happens if you put those two together? Well, my main take today is that, things from the occult sphere, meaning all these experimental attitudes and behaviors and different ways of looking at things, it's seeping into mainstream culture. And I see that as a very healthy thing. I see that as a very good thing. And it's just like endless. You can look at it from so many different angles. For instance, the purely pop aspect, how occultism and magic is so integrated in TV series and movies. And it's not, you know, some weird horror films like it used to be in the 70s or even up till the 80s. It is completely mainstream. It's so mainstream that it almost would be strange to not find a streaming service that did not have some series about teen witches or teen magicians or things like that. So it's occulture is very much alive, and it's very relevant that we do take a look at it because it's something that's going on. And the question for me, since I like looking at it again from different perspectives, is where will it go? Where will it go now? I don't know, but we'll find out.
we will find out. But the thing is that I think people think this is just a recent development. And of course, as you said, I think the occult has become more into the mainstream. I don't think there's any question about that. But, you know, if I look at American history, just the last 60, 70 years, we know that various presidents have consulted astrologers. You know, we had in the 60s, we had one of the most popular, well, two of the most popular TV shows in America were one about a witch, Bewitched, and one about a genie, I Dream of Genie, mm-hmm. which is derivative from the word djinn. So really this fascination with the occult, even though it's more out front today, this is stretched back decades and centuries, and has always been a part. You look at the early days of the spirit board, which became the Ouija board. I mean, this has been going on for a long time.
Oh, absolutely. And also, you know, America is such an interesting example, too, because, you know, it's not purely myth, but it's an actual fact that very much of, you know, the Constitution and the way it was put together initially was based on Freemasonry and Freemasonic ideals. And in that sense, you know, that kind of an environment for anyone who has not been involved in that is very ritualistic. It's very symbolic. You'd go on this sort of initiatory journey, which is symbolic, and there's like birth and death and rebirth rituals, and it's containing a lot of hocus pocus. Yet from that environment, the really good things about America stem. You know, for instance, about the, you know, equality and brotherhood, many of these ideals that came also from the French Revolution.
So in terms of culture, there are certain people who loom very large in the history of the occult and its growing acceptance. I was just going to name a couple of, kind of get your impressions and your thoughts on. And one, maybe the foremost, the one that most people think of is Aleister Crowley. Talk to us about Crowley and the impact that you feel he had and still his legacy is today.
Oh yeah, no, he's super interesting from your cultural point of view, because he is mainly known for two things. One is the systematization and the synthesizing of ideas, spiritual ideas from the East and from the West, and you're concocting his magical system, basically occult stuff. But he's probably more famous or infamous for the person that he was, you know, the impact that he made mainly through the British, you know, scandal press. And he liked that. He liked the attention, and he created the scandal basically wherever he went. So we have these two aspects that one part of him wanted to be, you know, regarded as a serious magician and occultist, which of course he was. And the other one wanted to be a scandalous person. Now, if we look at it, how is Crowley looked upon in culture today? Well, a tiny fragment, which is increasing, but it's kind of a small portion, are taking him very seriously. His works are out there in very nice books. His legacy is being taken care of in the best possible way. So his teachings and his philosophy is out there, which means that it's also part of culture. But if we look back to, you know, 1967, which was, you know, 41 years ago, there was this album by the Beatles that helped redefine a lot of things in popular culture, which was Sgt. Pepper's, the LP. And Crowley is on that portrait gallery on the front side of the sleeve. So already 20 years after Crowley died in 1947, he was sort of being lauded by this new underground rebellious generation who were actually fulfilling a lot of his prophecies, you know, experimenting with drugs, experimenting with sex, basically the hippie kind of lifestyle. So in that sense, I think that Crowley's legacy is bigger in the pop culture than in the sort of contemporary magical culture. I don't know whether he would mind or not. It's just a fact. But those are the two main legacies. And I guess if we put them together, then we get a fairly full picture of who he was. You know, I think he wouldn't have minded at all being in this mainstream, yet scandalous area.
And would he be, do you think he'd be surprised with the developments that this has become so accessible? And it almost struck me, and I talked to, I can't remember his name, Tobias Charlton, was that the Charlton?
Who
Charlton. Did a book on Crowley. It almost struck me that Crowley wanted to kind of shock, you know, the shock value. Let's shock people.
Oh, yeah.
And now, would he be a little, would he take a little umbrage in the fact that it's not so easy to shock people?
Probably. I think Crowley would have reacted like this. He would have, you know, in his own mind gone, whoa, this is fantastic. This is blowing my mind. So many things are going on. And a portion of these things can be traced back to my life and my teachings and stuff like that. That would be on his inside. Yet, on his outside, how he would express that to the world, he would say, "This is all my doing," because he was such a strong narcissist. So he would have wanted credit for basically everything having to do with sexuality, with drugs, experimentation, occult behavior, occulture, you know, all these things. Because he was also involved in culture himself. You know, he stemmed from the Golden Dawn, and that was a very cultural environment, not just by, you know, people who liked to paint, but they were actually serious established writers and poets and painters. And so he came from that, and he looked, regarded himself as Britain's finest poet. I don't know if I would go that far, but he was, you know, a published poet and a pretty decent one. So in that sense, he lived his life not only in sort of like a hocus pocus, isolated sphere, but he was totally aware of what's going on. And he had exhibitions of painting, his own paintings in Berlin, for instance, that was actually, you know, sacked by the Nazis and things like that. So I think that if Crowley were alive today, or if we could communicate, he would probably take a lot of credit for what was going on today.
Another person, and we talk about collective consciousness and different thoughts, Carl Jung. Talk to us about Jung and the impact you feel that he has had and continues to have to this day.
Right. I would say that that's very analogous to Crowley in a way that quite early on, Jung was taken on by popular culture, especially during the 60s, which was the decade when he died. But he was already, you know, catapulted into this very open, loose mind frame, made a little bit soft, sometimes mushy by psychedelic experimentation. But all of his key terms, they were such good, as you would call it today, memes. You know, he was a great meme maker, making up all these phrases, you know, introvert, extrovert, archetypes, all of these concepts that were very fascinating for this, you know, new age of Aquarius, as it was called, and I guess still is called. So in terms of him being a clinical psychologist from the beginning, which was of course the same environment as his friend and also super pioneer Sigmund Freud, they worked on these things together. Freud remained pretty esoteric and stuck to the scientific concepts, although Freud was actually very interested in you know, occult phenomena too. But Jung was more, he had problems with it, but he had to come to terms with that and actually was open about the fact that he gave many more things credence than what was simply being able, that you could simply observe in a clinical environment. So he was quite open to spiritual phenomena. Also, Jung traveled a lot into you know, parts of the world which then were called primitive, meaning, you know, more tribal, more unbroken traditions and lineages of magical things going on. So he integrated all of that. And then what happened, of course, was that Freud has remained in his fairly esoteric environment of psychoanalysis, and psychoanalysis is now a culture in itself. But Jung is part of our own, I wouldn't go so far as to say that the collective unconscious, but he's probably part of the collective conscious in that sense. And that's mainly because of all these wonderful terms that he came up with that are easy to use and you know, give, I hope, a lot of people inspiration to look at themselves merely by, you know, having those terms around. I think Jung is a great source of inspiration for many things today, both within and also outside the occult communities.
I do have one other person I want to ask you about. I don't want to just make a litany of asking about different people, but this one I'm interested in because I think in certain circles, maybe this person is not thought of very well. Maybe some think that maybe he was a bit of just kind of a con artist. Was there really a philosophy, or was it just a shtick, so to speak? Anton LaVey, of course, you know him as the late leader of the Church of Satan. Now, obviously, Satanism with many people, and I have to admit, I have a bias towards it myself. That just turns me off, just that idea. But we're having a discussion here, so I do want to explore. What do you think the importance of LaVey was, and was he really a spiritual leader? Was he a con artist? Was he a little bit of both? What are your thoughts on LaVey?
I think that there's a problem with the word spiritual in his sense, because he never used that word. And I know today for sure that the Church of Satan, they would not use that term spiritual. They would perhaps use the word like inner, you know, having to do with inner processes. However, the thing is that what began in earnest, meaning his, you know, magical circle in San Francisco, which was basically friends and acquaintances that grew and grew and grew, and then someone said, well, let's make something out of this, and they, you know, created a church, so-called the Church of Satan, which was of course super controversial, and then the Satanic Bible followed, and they sort of, or he made a career out of being this very controversial person who was, you know, too conservative for the hippie environment of San Francisco at that time, but he was also way too radical and liberal for the American conservatives. So he was sort of in between those two spheres, so to speak. And then, of course, you have the S word. The S word can be terrifying, especially in America, which is usually a very... it's a very Christian discourse, and I think even more so back then in the 60s. But what he constructed was very serious, and although there was a great sense of humor in everything he did and also the church, I think that he came up with some really radical concepts that were new, meaning they were not just plucked from an old bouquet of occult wisdom. He thought about integrating music, since he was such a good musician. He thought about things like scenography, or creating a room that defies time and space. He integrated literary inspirations and many things that at this time, which basically at this time in the 60s, there was, you know, a budding Crowley environment. There was a budding still Golden Dawn environment. There was a lot of Eastern stuff going on. So this was like brand new. It was not tying something into something old or arcane. It was new. So in that sense, I would say that he was very, very creative and totally for real and serious. At the same time, he had been formatted within the circus environment, and he knew exactly that people liked this, they liked that, this is controversial, this is not controversial, and also how to make money off of that. And he did do that for many decades, and then he became more and more reclusive, probably getting tired of the attention or of people attacking him all the time, and which is just, you know, a human thing. But the answer to your question from my point of view is that yes, he was super serious, and the controversy of the S word may have been a strategically scandalous thing that he, you know, that stuck with him, but I don't think he minded that. I think he just became a little bit embittered over the fact that people were actually so uptight or close-minded that they couldn't even have a discussion as long as the S word was there. That indicates some kind of intolerance, and that intolerance, I think, made him very tired.
Fair enough, because I was interested in that perspective. He, you know, there were so many things assigned to him, and it's interesting to get a different perspective from kind of what you hear from the general media. Here's a question. You know, When you think of the occult, you think of hidden knowledge, you think of the counterculture, but if it becomes the predominant culture, is it no longer hidden knowledge, and is it still the counterculture? It just becomes the culture. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right, absolutely. And then you have to sort of redefine what is it really about. And that's difficult, because if you look back, what would be like the common denominators for the arcane stuff? What were those guys and witches and sorcerers and scientists up to back then? And is it the same thing that's going on today? And I would say, yeah, in a way it is, because it's this weird dynamic that's so inspiring between the inner space and the outer space, you know, between the human mind and everything that's beyond it in the outer, including outer space. So those things, like what I mean is, for instance, that medieval Renaissance philosophers philosophized about the cosmos, how you know, cosmologies and things like that, but they did it in their own little chambers, their own little temples, and then they looked and they got better and better tools and could look out into space, etc. So it was a process that was both on in the inner and also on the outer. And in a way, that's absolutely going on today, where you have, for instance, a scientific community, meaning Silicon Valley and beyond, who are all into this phenomenon of microdosing, meaning using psychedelics for, you know, being in an epiphanic state more or less every day, each day during the workday, but at the same time working with things and other scientists with such advanced and abstracted ideas like quantum physics, you know, and real bending time, a process that's been going on for, you know, since Einstein, and all of these things. And of course, space travel and, you know, Elon Musk sending out his car out into space. There are so many things going on that those medieval primitive scientists could only, of course, dream of or fantasize about. Today, that's a total reality. And I think that it will be the same two main categories that will continue to fascinate these kinds of people. And it's basically inner space and outer space and the sort of the dynamic that's between them.
The occult, what can it do for us as individuals, in your view? What the study of it, maybe the practice of various tenets of it? Do you see it as something that's empowering? What can the practice of occult knowledge do for us? I know that's a big question because there's a lot of different occult knowledge out there and techniques and so forth, but what are your thoughts?
I think that if, again, we, you know, just make a quick stop, care of Crowley again, you know, he defined magic as the art and science of causing change to occur in conformity with will. That, of course, is a very 20th century kind of definition. It's very, you know, stripped and stark and in a way very causal, you know, meaning that, you know, it is my will to do this, then I do that. That takes away any kind of, you know, supernatural glamour. But if we stick with the slightly older or a bit more romanticized thing where you do a ritual, you use talismans and invocations and work with outer forces, then I would say that the main benefit of doing that is you have to look at that as some kind of constructive, helpful psychodrama. I used to think that there were, you know, outer forces helping me in this or that way. Now I ascribe more to the fact that we have everything in our mind. And these things that we talk to or do rituals with, or the rituals we do, it's a way of interacting with ourselves, deeper layers of ourselves. And if we call a force X or Y or Z, that doesn't mean that X or Y or Z are actually out there. They are, again, just as likely to be on the inside in our own minds and sort of putting the wires together in a conducive way to manifesting this thing that we're doing a ritual for. So I would say, yes, depending on what kind of ritual or occult culture that attracts you. It could be Western, it could be Eastern, it could be dark, it could be light. That's really, you know, it doesn't really matter as long as you're genuinely attracted to it, because you are attracted to it for a reason, so you should explore it. And then I think that you should, as with everything in life, you should experiment and see, does this work? You know, you should be a practical pragmatist, or in a way use some kind of empirical mind frame saying, you know, I'll give this a shot, or I'll give this two shots and we'll see if it works out. And if it does, then you might have a bigger problem than if it doesn't, because then you have to realize that, whoa, there's more to this than I thought. And hopefully that person will be so inspired and enthusiastic that he or she will, you know, carry on in the experimentation. So I think that a lot of arcane stuff can still be very, very usable. But I will say mainly usable for the purposes of psychodrama, meaning something you do to get to know yourself better. But, you know, different levels of yourself that you're normally in rational circumstances not really in touch with.
So in your view, and I'm maybe oversimplifying this, that the study of the occult and the practice of the occult is not necessarily as much to get in touch with some supernatural force, but it's to get in touch with yourself. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, there are many people who would argue, you know, like the opposite or kind of a mix. And maybe I actually, you know, shouldn't say that I ascribe to something. You know, everything is totally possible all the time. I mean, there are phenomena in nature that we can see or, you know, take part of with our senses, and it can be a shared experience. Other people can see this and, you know, experience the same thing. That means that it's not something going on solely in my mind. You know, and those things happen, you know, more than enough to convey or sort of suggest that there are things out there that we cannot, you know, explain right now. But then again, that's the exact same dilemma as in medieval times. Those pioneers tried to explain these things about, you know, hey guys, the sun is in the center, it's not the earth that's in the center of our universe. And for that, they got burned. You know, their eyes were poked out and they were burned. Luckily, that's not the case today. But of course, there can be a level of you know, some people who claim something extreme might be ostracized in society or in culture. But I think that, you know, why aren't physicists, you know, people working with extreme abstracted things like quantum physics, they are usually, you know, looked upon as you know, brave scientists, and they're well-funded and stuff like that. But it's still, if they would try to explain what they're doing, it would be complete hocus-pocus to a layperson. You know, so it very much has to do with who's sending out the message or the communication and who's receiving it. So if you want to clothe things in robes and funny hats and wands and things like that, it can be enthusiastic, could be psychodramatic. It could also generate change in the outer, because we don't really know, being laymen, how much effect these theoretical physics people actually cause. You know, it might be that they're just theorizing about things. So who knows? It's a very, very, very big field.
I was looking over the table of contents here, and something struck my eye in your chapter number 12, Formulating the Desired. Some similarities, right, between ritual magic and the psychoanalytic process. Very right. Interesting. It sounds like some of the things we've been talking about, but expound upon that, because that's fascinating to me, that magic has something in common with psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to me. So please expound on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very, I don't know, when you look at it, and when you look at it from the point of view that I did when I sat down and thought about these things, because I have experience from both fields, meaning I've been working with rituals and, you know, occult things and exploring it both in theory and practice for a long time, since the mid-80s, basically. And I was also, at a time, involved in psychoanalysis as someone lying down on the couch. And this was for a long time. This was 4.5 years, and I did that every day. So it was a very strong experience for me, and one that helped me a lot in my magical development. And I would hope it's also the other way around. But when I sat down later on to think about this and, you know, what similarities are there, there was this thing that popped up, and that was the concept of formulation, how important it is to formulate a message that's being sent out. In psychoanalysis, it's being verbalized, not so much to the analyst, but to yourself, basically. And in a magical ritual, you have to formulate either in symbolic form or in clear verbal form to whatever forces it is that you're in touch with, again, meaning possibly outside forces or most likely inside forces. No matter what, that kind of formulation needs, of course, to be, prequeled. It needs the prequel of also analysis, meaning, why am I doing this ritual? What's the exact purpose for it? And when you go down that route and not just sort of throw yourself into a temple with wands and other gimmicks, then you will come closer to some kind of, you know, bottom line or foundation. And that foundation may actually differ quite a lot from what you think when you start out. And you can say that, yeah, I want that this and that promotion at work. But when you look at it again, it might be because you want to impress someone at work. And what's the reason for that? Yeah, because you like these kinds of people that you want to impress. And why is that? Well, because you're unsure of your own sexuality, for instance. So you can always, always, always take it one step further back or deeper in a way. And that goes both for the occult research that you have to do when you're on that path, in that process. And it also very much is a valid angle when you look at psychoanalysis as a, you know, implemented practical technique of fixing yourself. You know, it's a slow process, but one of the reasons why psychoanalysis works is that it's not a quick fix. It's not a quick remedy to ease the pain or put a band-aid on some symptom. It's going deeper. So I would say that those two phenomena, ritual magic and psychoanalysis are very, very related.
Now, at the beginning of our discussion, you said, you know, who knows where all of this is headed, or something to that effect. And I think we both speculated, we don't know. But now I'm going to circle back and ask you, where do you think all of this may be headed? I don't know if that's fair, I will ask, where do you think we're going?
Well, I think that it ties in with a much bigger question, which is basically the same question. Where are we headed? Because if we look on a global scale today, I think we're headed straight to hell, basically. And I don't necessarily mean that the good aspects of hell or the fun aspects. I think that there are so many potentially bad things going on, and they're quite urgent. I think that during the course of human history, there have always been things happening that we can't really explain. That have helped us. Some of these things have been purely human constructs. Others have been flukes or mutations or strange adaptations that we've just had to face in a way and go with. And I think, for instance, that this thing that the hippies talked about back in the 60s, the age of Aquarius, Crowley talked about his Aeon of Horus, meaning that there's some kind of transition going on. That may or may not be the case. You know, we have no scientific data to prove that. However, if we look at that as a model or as a symbol or as a kind of myth with relevance, things have to change. And how can you change people? It's quite obvious that you can't change people for a long time by political oppression, by tyranny, by warfare. That will just create a pendulum movement that swings back and forth, back and forth. Things need to happen on the individual level. That's why I feel that occultism, which is always, always tied in with a very individualistic philosophy in all these different cultures that it's existed in, that's relevant. We need to look at these things that are going on together, but on individual levels. We need to come to terms with ourselves first, then work together to change these things. I'm very much usually inspired by Buckminster Fuller. He was such a great, great guy on so many levels. And he said this thing that you can't just change something that rarely works. You have to make sure first that the model is made obsolete. That's the first step. So you can't just exchange one model with a new model. It will probably contain the same kinds of malfunction or possible corruption or whatever. You have to make the old model completely obsolete, meaning that model simply cannot function in the new setup. So I think that a part of a new model is part individualism. It's part what I would call psychonautism, meaning that there's a degree of psychedelic experiencing, because that, to my experience, has brought a lot of people since the 60s onto a more holistic worldview. And that's a key to this. The key to fix the problems is a holistic worldview. And that doesn't mean that you have to do psychedelics all the time, but it can be interesting as an eye-opener to see a bigger perspective, a wider perspective, and see the Earth, the actual planet, as a living being to which we're all connected. So it's some kind of, you know, shamanic, pantheistic philosophy that I think will help save whatever human life is left.
Well, it is on that note that we tell you where you can find a culture, the unseen forces that drive culture forward. Carl, where can people find the book and more information about the contents therein?
I think that the most, the simplest way is simply to go to, I don't know if I should name it, but anyway, Amazon is not, it's such a big name anyway. Amazon have it, of course, in all the online bookstores. I would say that all the good physical bookstores, they will have this book too. But the easiest thing is, of course, to go to your normal online bookseller and get it there. It's a fun read. I recently reread it again, and I'm very, very pleased with it. Actually, it ties together well, and it makes you go, I never thought about that before.
Yeah,
and that's an important thing.
You got a lot of great comments from people like Mitch Horowitz, who has been on the program, Gary Lachman, who wrote the foreword, I believe, has been on the program. So you certainly got a lot of kudos on this book. The book is A Culture, The Unseen Forces That Drive Culture Forward. Our guest has been Carl Abramson. Carl, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jim. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for tuning in to The Other Side, and we will talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.